I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Today, a meditation on some of the most important resistance movements of the past 60 years. Civil rights luminary Dr. Mary Frances Berry joins me to discuss her latest book, History Teaches Us to Resist, How Progressive Movements Have Succeeded in Challenging Times. From her coverage of the Vietnam War for her college newspaper, to the fall of apartheid in South Africa, to her tenure as chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, Dr. Berry has stood as a witness to history. And she writes with erudition about how the lessons of protest movements of the past resonate with resistance today. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Center Stage's adaptation of George Orwell's dystopian classic, Animal Farm. First, the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us today. We had hoped to have a conversation this afternoon with Dr. Mary Frances Berry. She's an incredible person, a scholar, an author, and an activist. And she's written a new book. The book is called History Teaches Us to Resist, How Progressive Movements Have Succeeded in Challenging Times. Dr. Berry herself has been an activist and part of many progressive movements for decades. She's currently a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and she is on her way to Baltimore, but her train is stuck. And anybody who's ever commuted to Washington knows that feeling. We were told just a few minutes ago by Dr. Berry that the train has lost power, so she is not able to make it here probably in time for any of our program. However, she does show up. We will talk to her about this book. The book is fascinating. And Dr. Berry herself is a fascinating figure. She really is a witness to history. When she was a student at the University of Michigan back in the 1960s, she went to Vietnam during the summer of 1967 to cover the Vietnam War for the student newspaper at the University of Michigan. I mean, it's just a wild, wild thing. She just happened to be, for example, years later in the office of the mayor of Cape Town, South Africa, the day that Nelson Mandela was released from prison. So she was there for that. She was a member and then for a long time the chair of the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights. She was appointed by President Carter. She was removed from the commission by President Reagan because she had strong disagreements about the Reagan administration's civil rights policies. She sued to get her position on the commission back, and she won. Interestingly, she was removed from that commission along with a guy named Murray Saltzman. He was the rabbi at Baltimore Hebrew Congregation here in Baltimore. He also, with Dr. Berry, was removed from the commission by the Reagan administration. And they were reinstated. She went on to chair that commission. President Clinton appointed her the chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And she writes in this book about protest movements, resistance movements that have taken place all the way back to the Roosevelt administration. A. Philip Randolph, who was the leader of the Pullman Porters Union, the association there, the March on Washington that they planned to loosen up strictures on hiring African Americans in the defense industry during World War II. And she takes it all the way up through presidents since Roosevelt, right through the president, President Obama's tenure in office, and even mentions a little bit about the resistance movement to Donald Trump. So it's a fascinating book. I'm sorry we're not going to be able to talk to her about it today on Midday. However, if she does figure out how to get here sometime this afternoon, we will record a conversation with her about this book. If you would like to learn more about it, she will be speaking tonight at the Enoch Pratt Library, God willing, that she'll be able to get herself up to Baltimore between now and 6:30. So she's going to be at the Central Branch, the Central Library. It's not a branch. It's the main place. It's the HQ down on Cathedral Street. So the Enoch Pratt Library tonight, she's part of the Brown series at the Enoch Pratt, starts at 6:30. Again, the book is called History Teaches Us to Resist, How Progressive Movements Have Succeeded in Challenging Times, Dr. Mary Frances Barry. So speaking of resistance and movements, my first guest this afternoon, we're going to talk about a couple of different things. We're going to talk about some bills that are in the General Assembly of Maryland. Then we're going to talk to the Washington correspondent of the Baltimore Sun about what's going on in the 6th District Congressional race. And we're also going to speak with an editor at the Washington Post about the new Trump regulations restrictions and sanctions that have been imposed about imposed against Russia, having to do with cybersecurity and various other things. But I want to start with a person who has been very much involved in a resistance movement for quite some time. Davon Love is the director of public policy for Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle, and he's been working on and against actually some bills that are winding their way through the Maryland legislature. Davon Love, welcome back to Midday.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So there are a couple of bills. The Maryland Senate looks like it's pretty close to passing a crime bill that includes, I guess, an awful lot of what Governor Hogan thought should be in a crime bill. Tell us what that bill would do should it pass, and then tell us why your organization opposes it.
So the state of this bill is Senate Bill 122. And it actually already passed the Senate and will be making its way over to the House next week. So it does a whole host of things. It was really an attempt by Senator Zirkin to take, who's a senator
Zirkin
from
Bobby
County.
Zirkin. Uh-huh.
Bobby Zirkin. So it was an attempt to take aspects of the governor's package, which included things like increasing mandatory minimums, and trying to mesh them into what he was calling a bipartisan bill. What remains in the bill are what folks are calling sentence enhancements. So it's almost kind of like a backdoor in between an actual increase in mandatory minimum while still trying to give judges discretion. And again, a part of our issues with sentence enhancements is that, you know, the history of that, when you look back to the tough on crime era, which was an era where people were trying to legislate a decrease in crime, what actually happened was that it increased the number of folks susceptible to being swept up by the criminal justice system. So even if you add what this bill does, it adds on top of existing mandatory minimums, 5 years that are parolable and suspendable. That creates a context where now you're hanging over the head folks that have to do those 5-year mandatory minimum, additional jail time. And again, the history of those types of legislative approaches have not decreased crime, but they've increased incarceration.
For example, Dave, on one of the aspects of this bill, this is a kind of offense that perhaps could result in a longer jail term under this Senate bill, is if you are convicted for a second time of using a handgun during a crime. Doesn't necessarily have to be a murder, but using a handgun during a crime. So a lot of folks would say, well, look, you know, you do it once, that's a mistake. You perhaps go to jail, you pay your debt to society, but boy, you come out of jail and you do it again. This is, you're a person that society has a right to lock up, because clearly you've shown a propensity for, you know, criminal behavior that is repetitive. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, and that's a really good question. One of the things I actually had an exchange with Chairman Zirkin yesterday during testimony on an entirely separate bill. One of the things that I explained to him in the committee is that when we look at how the criminal justice system actually works, so we remember from, you know, 1999 to 2006, Martin O'Malley was a part of a zero tolerance policy where there were 757,000 legal arrests. So people that were just picked up, arrested, and may or may not have been charged with something. So that's just one example that we know documented of excessive arrests. And we know that a lot of people, you know, in you know, communities in Baltimore that have highly concentrations of poverty, you know, people don't have the kind of money and resources for the kinds of lawyers that would help them be able to defend themselves. And so what we have in our community are folks that may have been charged with a lot of extreme things, but had to plea down to maybe, you know, lesser crimes. So things like possession of a firearm and commission of a crime may be something that you plead to, right? Because you don't want to go to trial and you don't feel like you have good legal representation that can make sure that you don't do jail time. And we have lots of people in our community with that situation. Our argument is that what those sentence enhancement does is that it makes those folks vulnerable to having to spend more time in jail who are better served not being in jail. The other piece I want to also say to your listeners as well, you know, because the examples we keep hearing, you know, a 97-year-old brutally murdered, right? And what we say to that is, well, you charge that person with murder and you get them locked up for what they did. What the sentence enhancements are doing, they don't get at the person who killed the 97-year-old, right? The way that you get the person who killed the 97-year-old is you have a police department that is more competent in its ability to bring good cases to the state's attorneys to be able to get those folks off the streets. And there's no way to get around that. And I would argue that a lot of the legislative push to enhance sentences to address crime it's a way to get around the fact that you have to address the corruption in the police department and its inability to be able to get folks that murder people. That should be our focus, mm-hmm. not these sentence enhancements.
And you know, Governor Hogan calls sentence enhancement truth in sentencing, meaning if you are convicted of a crime and sentenced to something, many people are getting out earlier than the actual mm-hmm. limit of the sentence on parole. And he says that this is putting dangerous people back on the street. There are some provisions in this bill, as I understand it, that fund things like safe streets, which is a very proven, effective way of intervening with violence that even before it happens on the streets of Baltimore and cities throughout Maryland. So there are some things that the bill, I think, that I assume that the Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle would support. What should a crime bill, if legislatively at the state level, if the Maryland legislature is going to try to address the spike in crime that we've experienced here in Baltimore, certainly over the last 2 or 3 years, what do you think should be in the public policy package to address the violence on our streets?
Well, I think it would require a few things. One is, you know, comprehensive civilian oversight of law enforcement. You know, as your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the Gun Trace Task Force. Them finding that police officers were engaged in selling drugs, robbing people, having a toy gun they would use to plant on folks if they felt like they needed it to cover themselves, right? And so there's no way that we can expect the police to do anything about homicides if they're compromised to that level, where there's that level of corruption. Mm-hmm. So a more robust civilian oversight of law enforcement so that there's a greater trust, so that folks feel like they can be allies in trying to stop the homicide in their communities. That's one piece.
And that really is a very important piece, isn't it? Because, you know, when it comes to witness intimidation, that is also part of the problem that the police and the state's attorney's office encounter every day. It's very difficult to find people who can give information that they may have about crimes that have been committed because there simply is no trust in the police department.
Right. There's no trust. And there quite frankly aren't enough resources invested in witness protection. You know, I think that's one of the things that I think most people would agree that would be a good idea, but the folks kind of question whether it's the political will to make the investments in something like that as opposed to, you know, these sentence enhancements. Mm-hmm. More robust civilian oversight, funding of Sixth Street. And I even mentioned to the chairman when I interacted with him yesterday that funding for State Street is good. But to put that in a bill that increases, that has those sentence enhancements, creates a context where it's utilizing the good that a program like Safe Streets could do in an effort to push forward legislation that, again, would have the effects that I mentioned earlier.
Do you have, Davon, as we finish up here, and I appreciate your coming on at the last minute and making yourself available. Very grateful for you for that, but basically this also comes down to who has trust in the judiciary, because the legislature and Governor Hogan in particular seems to be, heck-bent on tying the hands of judges. He thinks that the individual discretion of judges is often part of the problem. Do you and does your organization have just a fundamentally more robust confidence in the judiciary than in, for example, the police department or the state legislature?
So here's the thing about that I find interesting is that, you know, and particularly Republicans, but even some Democrats in the state of Maryland, are often fearful of criticizing the police department. In fact, you know, being in Annapolis, I have not heard legislators either the context of the crime bill, talk about the gun chase task force and what it revealed to the general public, which a lot of us kind of already knew. The fact that the governor would criticize the judiciary, but I've not heard any criticism on his part of the nature of corruption in Baltimore City. He may have referenced it as a problem that needs to be solved, but to criticize the judiciary and say that the judiciary, is not guaranteeing the public safety of Marylanders, while simultaneously not putting the same effort and energy into addressing the more rampant, more evident, more impactful corruption of the police department, just shows part of the problem as to why things are the way they are.
Davon Love is the Director of Public Policy for Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle. Davon Love, appreciate it. We will, of course, stay in touch about this bill and the other bills that you and organizations like the Legislative Black Caucus are keeping their eye on. So thanks so much, and we'll talk to you soon. Appreciate it.
Yep. Appreciate it, Tom.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Again, we had hoped to speak with Dr. Mary Frances Berry. She is on a train that is not moving out of Union Station in Washington. She's not able to be here. But coming up, we're going to talk to John Fritzy. He is the Washington correspondent for the Baltimore Sun. We're going to talk about a very interesting race, the 6th congressional race, 6th congressional district here in Maryland, which has an open seat. John Delaney holds that seat. He's running for president, so it is a wide open field. We're going to talk to John Fritzy about what's going on over there. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. And now we move from the halls of the State House in Annapolis to the Capitol in Washington. John Fritzy joins me. He is the Washington Bureau Chief of the Baltimore Sun. John, how are you doing?
Hey, Tom. Good. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks. I'm interested in your story that ran today in the Sun about this incredible race in the 6th District, which is being vacated by John Delaney, who hasn't been in it very long, who's decided to run for president. Give us the lay of the land in the Maryland 6th.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really the most significant congressional race in Maryland next year, and that's because I think it has the potential to be the most competitive. It's certainly got a lot of candidates lining up for the open seat. I think there are 8 Democrats at this point that are running, about a half a dozen Republicans running. You know, that's pretty natural for any open seat. This one is I think especially worth noting because in the last midterm, in the last off-cycle election, John Delaney, who was running for a second term, came very close to losing. In fact, it was one of the few districts in the country that went way past election night in terms of getting a call, and he ended up winning, I think, by a few thousand votes. And so it's an interesting race to watch for that reason alone. But the story we wrote today had to deal with opioids and the significance of that issue's taken in the race.
Yeah, and you've got 2 candidates who have a very personal connection to the opioid crisis, Christopher Hearsey, who's an aerospace engineer, and David Trone, who I guess owns a very large liquor distribution company.
Yeah.
This is not the first time Mr. Trone has thrown his hat in the ring for a seat in Congress, although the last time it was a different district. How does that work?
Right. So Trone actually lives in the 8th, I believe, trying to remember this now. He is running in the 6th, or it was vice versa. A lot of these candidates actually do not live in the district, which is sort of interesting this time around. But, you know, the 8th, I think, is an interesting template to look at. You know, the 8th, the neighboring 8th district, also Montgomery County-based, was a huge contest in the last cycle because it was open. It's Chris Van Hollen's old seat. He, of course, ran for senator and won. And so you had a bunch of candidates lining up to run a really messy primary, particularly on the Democrat, and a lot of money being spent. And driver of that. He's a wealthy guy. He would be one of the most wealthy members of Congress if elected. And he, you know, really has no bones about putting in millions of dollars of his own money, into these races. And in the last cycle when he ran in the eighth, he really blasted the airwaves down here in Washington. He was all over the place.
Yeah, and it's interesting. If I recall correctly, at the time, it was the most expensive congressional race in the country. It perhaps got eclipsed when John Ossoff ran in Georgia against Karen Handel and then lost that race. And interestingly, Ossoff lost that race in large measure because he was pinned as a guy who didn't live in the district. Marylanders seem to have a much higher tolerance for that than Georgians. That's kind of interesting.
They do, and I think part of it is that because of how the lines are drawn and people are so uncomfortable with the redistricting in Maryland that's part of the reason for the ability to live with that. John Delaney, the incumbent in the 6th, does not live in the district as well.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about Mr. Trone and Mr. Hearsey and their particular connection to the opioid crisis, which, of course, is a crisis affecting not just Maryland, and it's affecting every jurisdiction in Maryland, not just the city of Baltimore, but the more rural and suburban areas of the state as well, including much of the 6th district. But it is interesting that both of these candidates have a very deep personal connection to this crisis.
Yeah, and actually not just those two. The thing that I find really striking about this race is that virtually every one of the candidates, I led the story with those two, but the Republican candidate had a relative schwunk, if it is, she wants to protect. Republican Ami Hober had a relative that she helped through treatment. Delegate Aruda Miller had a brother-in-law who died, and no one knew he even had this addiction in the family. At least she didn't. What I find compelling about the race and the reason why I think this has become such an issue is that, like a lot of us, every candidate has a personal story to tell about the epidemic. And specifically, David Trone has been talking a lot about his nephew. You know, interesting case because Trone does have a lot of money, and he really took this nephew on. He hired attorneys to help him through his legal battle. He got him the best care that really money could buy, and they thought they had helped him, and he still overdosed and died, which I think is sort of a telling. It sort of speaks to the complexity of this problem. Even when you have the resources to deal with this, it's a very hard struggle for a lot of people.
Yeah, I know. Delegate Miller, she's a Democrat. She's from Darnestown. I guess she lost her brother-in-law just last September. I mean, this is a very fresh wound for many of these people. Is there any consensus, at least on the Democratic side, for example, about how the opioid crisis should be addressed at the federal level?
So I think there's interesting politics here. David Trone, I think, deserves some credit for being the first Democratic candidate, at least, to weigh in with a pretty detailed plan. He talked about investing $100 billion. He would support investing $100 billion over 10 years. That's far more money than Congress has talked about. It's not clear to me that there would be a political appetite for that. But he's put some ideas on the table. He was out very early with sort of a position paper on this issue, and I think that's put a lot of the other candidates in sort of an awkward position of wanting to criticize Trone on this sensitive issue, but also wanting to distinguish themselves from him a little bit. So I think the thing I heard the most in this story is a lot of people saying, yeah, $100 billion would be good and would be helpful, but, you know, we need to be careful that we're not just throwing money at the problem. And so that's an interesting point. I will note that a lot of public health experts, including Baltimore's health commissioner, when you talk to her, Liana Nguyen, about this issue, one of the first things she says in terms of what she needs from Washington is more treatment dollars. And so I don't think Trone is far out of line with what a lot of public health folks are saying. But there is this other argument that, hey, it's not just about money. You have to make sure you have smart programs, that the money is going to programs that actually work and help people.
Yeah, and of course, Dr. Nguyen, who appears on our program very regularly, we talk about the opioid crisis here in the city with great frequency. And one of the issues that she's facing is she's having to ration naloxone or Narcan, which is the drug that is administered when a person is experiencing an overdose, and she just simply doesn't have enough to go around because there's so many people who are having that terrible problem. I wonder, John, given that we've just had this amazing race in the 18th district in Pennsylvania, suburb of Pittsburgh, and then southwestern Pennsylvania, and yet this young man, Connor Lamb, wins as a Democrat in a district that Donald Trump carried by nearly 20 points in the presidential election in 2016. Does that, there are a lot of people saying, you know, this is going to foreshadow a Democratic wave in 2018. But I wonder, politically, strategically, have any of the Democrats or Republicans given any indication that they're learning some lessons, they're taking some things away from this Connor Lamb victory in Pennsylvania?
Yeah, well, there's two races, I think, to talk about in regards to PA 18, and one is the sixth. And it's an open seat. I think at this point, if the election were held today, it is a very difficult environment for the Republican. Ami Homer is the Republican with the most resources and is sort of expected to clinch the nomination, but there are several other Republicans running as well. But whoever emerges from that primary, I think, if the election were held today, would face a very difficult environment, particularly in an open seat, when experts sort of suggest that voters who may not know the candidates super well tend to vote based on their thoughts on what's happening in Washington. And what's happening in Washington is Donald Trump, and he's not all that popular in Maryland. The other district to watch is the first district. That is our only Republican-held district. It's held by Andy Harris of Baltimore County. It's got the Eastern Shore and kind of curves around the bay. There are some hopes on the Democratic side that PA 18 suggests that Maryland's first district could be competitive. I'm somewhat skeptical of that right now. There is a guy named Jesse Colvin, Democrat. He outraised Harris in the fourth quarter financially in fundraising, so that's significant and worth keeping an eye on. And it could. You know, I'm watching it closely. It's worth noting that Maryland won. Trump won by way more than 20. He was in the upper 30s, depending on how you look at it.
Right.
And Andy Harris won that seat by close to 40 points. And so I could see Democrats having a wave and Andy Harris still holding on in the first. It's a very Republican district. The question is, I think, you know, can the Democratic candidates, whoever the nominee is, really turn out people, and do Republicans stay home? And, you know, we won't know that till we get closer to it, I think.
And, of course, a lot of people say that Mr. Lamb was successful because he localized the election. He didn't want it to be about Donald Trump. He wanted it to be about the concerns that people had in the 18th District of Pennsylvania, not the concerns they had with Mr. Trump and his temperament and all the chaos that's going on in his White House. It's an interesting strategy in Pennsylvania. We'll see how it develops for all of the congressional races here in Maryland. And we will, of course, keep reading John Fritzy in the Baltimore Sun to figure out what's going on. John, I appreciate the time today. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thank you.
John Fritzy is the Washington Bureau Chief of the Baltimore Sun. We're going to take a very quick break, and when we come back, we'll move now from the halls of Congress to the Kremlin. We're going to talk about sanctions that have just been announced by the Trump administration to punish Russia for any number of various nefarious things that the administration and people around the world are accusing them of doing. We're going to talk to Will England. He is the editor on the foreign desk at the Washington Post. That will be right up when we come back from a quick break. Stay with us. And welcome back. It is, in fact, midday. I'm Tom Hall. Again, if you've just joined us, we were hoping to have a conversation with Dr. Mary Frances Berry. She's an activist and author who's written a terrific new book called History Teaches Us to Resist: How Progressive Movements Have Succeeded in Challenging Times. She made as good an effort to get here as anybody could, but she is stuck on a train between Washington and Baltimore. She will be appearing tonight at the Enoch Pratt Central Library at 6:30. It's part of the Brown series that they run there, so I would highly encourage encourage you to go down and check out what Dr. Barry has to say. And we hope to have an interview with Dr. Barry to air at some point in the future. But now we turn to a good friend of our program, Will England. He is an author and reporter and editor. He currently is an editor on the foreign desk at the Washington Post, and he helps coordinate the Russia coverage for the Post. Will, welcome back to Midday.
Thanks very much, Tom.
So Ellen Nakashima, one of your reporters, published a piece just a little more than an hour ago about new sanctions that the Trump administration has announced against Russia. Tell us what's going on with that.
Well, these are sanctions because of a determination by the U.S. government that Russian hackers and spy agencies interfered in the 2016 presidential election and took part in a cyber attack against Ukraine and other countries last year that was, they have characterized as the most destructive and costly in history. So we have a number of Russian individuals and organizations that have been sanctioned, 19 people, five organizations. Some of them are those who were indicted recently by Robert Mueller. You may remember that. And some of them are already under sanction for their involvement in Russia's activities in Ukraine. But this is a rather striking move by the Trump administration against Russia. And the language that Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin used was quite strong. He talked about these targeted sanctions are part of a broader effort, I might add, I might note, to address the ongoing nefarious attacks emanating from Russia.
Now, that seems to be very much in contrast to the President of the United States, who seems to be one of the few people in the country to take a very hard stand or to take a very vocal stand against Russia when it comes to influencing the election, when it comes to even things like cybersecurity. I mean, he famously said during the general election, one of the debates that, you know, it could be Russia, it could be China, it could be some 400 guy sitting in bed in New Jersey. I mean, this is kind of striking that given that the administration seems to be making these moves, but the president himself doesn't seem to be on board with them.
Well, you know, it is interesting, isn't it? And let me just bring up another Russia story that's in the news, which is the chemical weapons attack in Britain last week. The U.S. this morning joined Britain, France, and Germany in denouncing that attack and saying it was highly likely to have been ordered by Russia and carried out by Russians. So somewhat belatedly, the U.S. is getting on board with that one as well. But you're right. Trump continues to hedge his bets when asked about Russia. Today he was asked, and he came out more strongly than he has in the past, again, about the chemical weapons attack. And he said, it really looks like it was Russia, and that's a very bad thing.
Well, Theresa May has expelled 23 diplomats from London, or from England, Russian diplomats. It's expected that a number of British diplomats will be expelled from Russia in return. You were a Moscow correspondent for many years. You've studied the Kremlin. You've been there, and you know these. You know the way this works. Is there any indication that the United States is going to expel any diplomats from our shores?
No, not at this point. And I would honestly, I would be a little bit surprised if that were to happen in connection with this case. I mean, this is a British matter. The British have to be taking the lead on it. Whether there might be a determination that some diplomats here were involved in interfering in the 2016 presidential election, that could lead to some activity, I suppose. But even given the sanctions that were imposed today, and none of the targets were diplomats, I think I'd be a bit surprised if the White House was willing to go that far in acknowledging Russian interference in 2016.
Republicans and Democrats, folks from both sides of the aisle, they include people, our own Senator Ben Cardin, who was until Mr. Menendez was reinstated in that position, was the ranking member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Bob Corker from Tennessee. Many people have chided the administration for not imposing, not acting on the sanctions that Congress approved months ago. What's different about this set of sanctions from the ones that were approved a while ago? And why is there any confidence that, in fact, these sanctions will be imposed and they will have some meat?
Well, I mean, the one thing I would point out is that these are sanctions coming out of the Treasury Department, acting under previously passed legislation. So when they announce sanctions, it's like announcing regulations. In a sense, this becomes, if not a law, it becomes, you know, the practice of the United States. So I think we can be assured that these do have meat to them. The question that some people have raised, though, is really, you know, are they anything more than symbolic? For instance, two of the organizations that were sanctioned are the FSB, the Security Service, and the GRU, which is the Military Intelligence Agency.
So the United States sanctioning the equivalent of the CIA in Russia, right?
Yes, and of the Defense Intelligence Agency, in a sense.
Yeah.
Both are already under sanction for their activities in Ukraine, and it's not like either of them, you know, has a bank account in the United States that can be sanctioned. So
right.
In some sense, there's a little bit of symbolism going
now,
on here.
Unrelated to the sanctions, but happening at the same time, the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, according to Ellen Nakashima's story in the last hour, are releasing what they call malware indicators related to Russia and their possible attempts to infiltrate things like the electric grid and the water system. Tell us a little bit about that as we finish up here.
Well, and also looking, I think, at state elections boards, the fear about the infiltration of the electric grid is palpable. I mean, that's an area where where Russia could, you know, really bring an awful lot of the U.S. to a standstill if it were to launch a cyber attack. I think, I'd be awfully surprised if the Russians did that, you know, short of a state of war, because it would probably be taken as an act of war if they did.
Yet we are told to be careful, nonetheless, right?
That, yes.
To be on the lookout. I mean, a malware indicator. I mean, how much help does that give? You know, a company or even a personal person using her personal computer.
I think those are more useful for the utility companies and those sort of things. I'd say, yeah, put, you know, be on alert and keep a stack of candles in your kitchen drawer.
Good advice from the gentleman who directs the Russia coverage for The Washington Post, Will Englund, former Moscow correspondent and writer for the Baltimore Sun, as well as The Post. Will, I very much appreciate it. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you. Anytime.
I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Coming up in just a bit, theater critic J. Wynn Russick will join Midday's senior producer Rob Sivak. They're going to talk about Baltimore Center Stage's new production of an Orwell classic, Animal Farm. So if you read it in junior high school, you can hear about it right here on Midday after we take a quick break. Again, our guest today was to have been Dr. Mary Frances Berry. She is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania and the author of a new book called History Teaches Us to Resist, How Progressive Movements Have Succeeded in Challenging Times. She's going to be at the Enoch Pratt Library tonight at 6:30. We hope to have an interview with Dr. Berry to play for you at some time in the near future. Our thanks to Davon Love from Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle, John Fritzy from the Baltimore Sun, and Will Englund from the Washington Post for filling in today. And thank you for everybody giving us a listen so far. Stick with us. We will be right back.